And it took 20 minutes.
All right.
We're ready.
Understanding.
Tape, because I don't think it's tape.
It could be.
Good morning. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. It is March 26, 2015. Good morning. Welcome, everyone. We are in the last of the hearings we have before the second deadline, and we have six, seven bills here that we'd like to try to move through. So, as I always say, please stay very focused on that. We're going to use the time here for you to tell us what the policy is that you're talking about. And if you can stay focused on that, what's in the bill, a brief description of the problem, but right to the how the bill is related to that, and allowing some time for questions from the committee. We really like to talk with you rather than just hear repetitious testimony. So that's for this bill, which will be Senator Claussen's bill, Senate File 988, and other bills as you go forward. I'm hoping you're hearing our message. And because it's the last hearing, I just wanted to say that last hearing before second deadline, that after this, we will have a periodic hearing. I want our members to know that, too. For the purposes of reviewing some reports that we've requested, like the report that's come out now in review of the Board of Nursing, that's coming forward for us to have a look at. There's also language that's being put together to implement Senate File 4, which is the Child Protection Task Force. It's language that relates to how we will fund and distribute the resources on that bill to counties and the role that they will play. So because that's going directly to finance, but there is language in there that I think this committee might have an interest in at least reviewing and understanding, I anticipate that the first Wednesday after the break, we will have a meeting at noon on that day. So please include that in your schedule. We'll send out a notice about that. Otherwise, I don't think we'll be meeting as regularly, and you'll have more time to do the other work that we're confronted with for the rest of the session. So with that, please begin. Senator Claussen, welcome to the committee.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 988. It's a proposal to exempt providers of durable medical equipment from Medicare payment limits. And, Madam Chair, I would like to offer the A4 amendment.
This is the first hearing. Mm-hmm. There's an author amendment being offered. It's the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
Yes. I'll move that.
As Senator Lori said.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Lori. Durable medical equipment includes prosthetics, orthotics, and medical supplies which fall under the Federal Medicare Competitive Bidding Program for home care durable medical equipment. Examples of this equipment include home oxygen equipment, walkers, hospital beds, lifts, wheelchairs, traction equipment, just to name a few items. If competitive bidding were to be applied to Minnesota Medicare, unsustainable reimbursement rates would force Minnesota durable equipment providers to close, an outcome that would leave families with reduced access to equipment and supplies that are essential to living independently within the community. Senate File 988 would de-link the Medicare fee schedule from Minnesota health care program payment rates. The language allows the commissioner to exempt a provider from the competitive bidding requirements under two conditions. The first being the bill allows the commissioner to exempt a provider if they are providing a medical assistance service that is not covered under Medicare. And second, a provider may receive an exemption to ensure access to the equipment and the commissioner determines there are no other vendors available to provide the necessary equipment. Minnesota has historically been a provider and supporter of programs and services for the disabled and a national leader on integrating the disabled into the community. Timely access to durable medical equipment supplies is absolutely necessary for individuals receiving care in community settings. Without reliable and consistent access to durable medical equipment supplies, individuals will be forced into more costly institutional settings to receive care, which is inconsistent with the goals of the Minnesota Olmsted Plan and the Americans with Disabilities Act. Senate File 988 preserves the durable medical equipment and supplies network of providers that help make independent living care possible. And offering testimony today, our first two testifiers, Sarah Anderson, Key Medical Supply, and Cami Ozender, General Counsel for Pediatric Home Services.
Thank you. And who would like to begin? Ms. Anderson?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Say your name into the microphone and please begin your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Sarah Anderson. I'm a board member for the Minnesota Association of Medical Equipment and Supplies and Vice President at Key Medical Supply. We thank you for the opportunity to come and talk about this issue. A little background on the Medicare program. As Senator Claussen said, the Medicare Competitive Bid Program was begun in 2013. That program sought competitive bids that were non-binding and allowed for suicide bids from providers who were specialists in geriatric service provision, not specialists in disability provision. So the Medicare program that was resulted in some very, very low reimbursement rates that are unsustainable when providing services to a population like a Medicaid population. We have some testifiers today. They're going to further expand upon that. The rates, as Senator Claussen mentioned, are on average a 46% reduction from current reimbursement rates. These are absolutely unsustainable. And in the programs that, in the areas where these rates were implemented in Medicare, we have seen tremendous attrition in the network of providers. In your packets, there is some information on the winners in the Minnesota provision, in the Minnesota area where Medicare competitive bidding is currently in place. And you're seeing the providers who were selected for the Medicare population. Of the 15 providers selected to provide power wheelchairs, only four of them are within 50 miles of the Twin Cities. Many of the local providers in our area have that submitted bids were not selected or who were offered contracts under these rates chose not to accept them because they simply could not operate their businesses at these reimbursement rates. So what we're looking for, and you can see in all of the different product categories where this dramatic access, this dramatic network constriction will take place. The other thing that we are looking to do is where this program is currently only operating in the metropolitan statistical area of Minneapolis and St. Paul. In 2016, it would be statewide. So the rural complication of having to get products to individuals in greater Minnesota at rates that are unsustainable, even within the MSA, is something that we are very concerned with as providers in terms of the impact on the access. And I'm going to turn it over to my fellow testifier, Cami Ozender, to talk a little bit about, a little more about our issue.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Ozender. Please say your name into the microphone and begin your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Cami Ozender. I am general counsel with Pediatric Home Service. We are a comprehensive home care provider specializing in the needs of medically complex children. One of the services we provide are durable medical equipment and supplies. And like my colleague, we are also a member of the Midwest Association of Medical Equipment Suppliers. I would just like to briefly touch on the inherent differences between our Medicare and Medicaid programs. Things as basic as the people that are served, to the complexity of the products that they require, to the policies that help to ensure access to those necessary services. Under the Medicaid population, we are looking to provide access to care for those who have unique health care needs, specifically in the state of Minnesota and for the industry that we represent. Those needs are most often accessed by our disabled community as well as medically complex children. The state has historically been highly supportive in ensuring access to services by the way that policies have been designed to access through Minnesota Medical Assistance to the specialty products that are made available to meet the needs of this very unique population. Where we run into a struggle is that Medicare doesn't distinguish between what would be a routine piece of equipment or a routine supply, as does Medicaid. So, for example, at Pediatric Home Service, we carry over 200 types of tracheostomy tubes, almost 200 different variations of formula. These are medically necessary to keep these children at home. But with Medicare, they don't recognize those specialties, so that the reimbursement provision, as my colleague Sarah states, is simply unsustainable. What we're asking to do is to preserve access to these specialty products. Home medical equipment supplies and suppliers are the lowest cost provider. What happens, what could happen here in the state is that certainly the need is not going to go away. These children and our disabled community will continue to have need for these products, but the access to the lowest cost provider will go away. And the alternate, unfortunately, is certainly more expensive, but also greatly reduces the quality of life for this community definitely deters their access to home and community-based services, which has been a longstanding goal here in the state of Minnesota. With that said, I think it's also important that we recognize that this access is not limited to beneficiaries of the Medicaid program. As Medicaid providers, we are required to not discriminate based on payer type. If we make a product available to a patient that does not have Medicaid, we must make that same product, the same quality of product, the same specificity of product available to a Medicaid beneficiary. Without doing that, we are in violation of our provider agreement. So if we are unable to provide these products to Medicaid patients, that same access issue extends to every member of this state that may require the product. What we're looking to do, again, is just preserve access to these necessary pieces of equipment and supplies.
Thank you, Ms. Zender. Senator Clausen, we have a couple other names here. Were they?
We do, yes. Debbie Harris and then Mark Hughes would also like to testify.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Harris, will you be beginning?
Yes, I will.
Please say your name into the microphone.
Thank you. Begin
your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Debbie Harris, and I'm from Egan. And I'm here to talk about my son, Joshua. My husband and I have three boys, and our youngest is Joshua, and he was born at 31.8 weeks, so he was premature. But for the time, it wasn't that premature. However, he had a number of complications, including a grade 4 brain hemorrhage at birth. And so subsequently, he has what's called tracheal malacia and laryngeal malacia. So he can't sustain his airway. He can't keep his airway open without a trach tube. And so very many years ago, we sat in a large room kind of like this one before the ethics committee and a number of staff at the hospital and talked about if it was futile or if it was ethical to place a tracheostomy in a patient whose outlook wasn't very promising. And so my husband, who was in the Marine Corps for 33 years, he thought about tracheostomies as something of a last resort. And his perception of it was something he had remembered from when he was in Vietnam, and they would place emergency trachs, you know, metal trachs in the field. And so even for him, it was a drastic effort, but technology has changed so much. And so we made the decision at that meeting that Josh would have a tracheostomy, and it essentially saved his life. And so now Josh is 22 years old, and he's the joy of our lives. He lives at home with us. He attends a community fine arts program once or twice a week. He plays adaptive baseball with lifelong friends and Mike's All-Stars in Burnsville. He watches MSNBC with his grandpa and Fox News with his nurse. He's very well-rounded. he attended Egan schools, and he was very he was included. So he went to school with his age-appropriate peers. And he loves audiobooks and Chronicles of Narnia and church and family gatherings. And I just wanted to give a picture of Josh as a person and as a viable person who is now thriving because of the technology that has come into place during his lifetime. So he was kind of one of the front runners of children who was never expected to live this long. We were told to take him home and that he would live 2 months, and then they changed their minds and told us he would only live 2 weeks, and now he's 22. And ever since then, we've been living life 20 minutes at a time, so that's a lot of 20-minute units. So technology has changed, and so have attitudes toward people with disabilities. And advancement in management and administration of pediatric home care has led to young people like Josh just being a very viable part of the community. So because our family has military insurance, we have TRICARE, so they use many of the same rules as Medicare. And so because their concentration is on equipment that's basically, meant for older people when they are in kind of the waning years of their lives, it's not necessarily suitable, and the rules aren't suitable for these children who started out at a time where technology was really kind of on a trajectory. And so they weren't looking at 6 months or even 6 years. It's been 22 years. And so historically, those rules weren't structured for children like Josh. That demographic wasn't part of the thought process. And so now, basically what we've relied upon is medical assistance for Josh has been kind of a lifeline for him. Because those products that aren't necessarily covered by our insurance or by Medicare, Josh is on Medicare as well now, are covered in Minnesota through medical assistance. And so Josh has a trach tube. Like, Josh has a very tiny neck, so just very tiny neck, and he's got very high muscle tone. And so he has a tendency, when he was very small, he would just always turn his head to the side. And we thought it was part of his muscle conditions. And then we found out that his trach tube was too short, and it was too hard for him to manage. And so he always kept his head to the side. And then after a while, so different types of trach tubes were developed, and they're called hyperflex. So they're very malleable and soft and very long. And it changed his entire life. And I know it sounds, I probably make big deals out of what people consider small things, but he's able to turn his head and look at people and interact and participate in life in a completely different way than this other tube was providing. And those kind of specialty things, those kind of specialty items wouldn't be available to young people like Josh, including, and he's also, he has a feeding tube. And so the type of feeding tube he has allows him to move. It allows him to go to PT and roll and so forth. And so those type of things wouldn't be available either. So I just thank you for your time and just wanted to use Josh's example as a good one for the type of situation that this would benefit greatly.
Thank you. Thank you for your story. It's very interesting and lays the foundation for what the need is that's being corrected in this bill. We have one final testimony. Mr. Hughes, Mark Hughes, thank you. Please assist us in adding to the discussion, and then we need to allow some time for questions, so I'm hoping that we can move through this fairly quickly.
Good morning, members of the committee, Senator Sharon. My name is Mark Hughes. I'm a 12-year former board member of the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities and still active in some periodic projects with them. I'm here today to discuss the durable medical goods issue. It affects many of us in the disabled community. You wanted to talk about policy. Some of the policy in this has to change. The disability community is not being serviced well. There's two ways that's looked at. There's a 46% rate cut that you've heard about for the providers or contractors. And so we've got four providers now within a 50-mile radius of the Twin Cities. Well, for those of us that do work, it's kind of hard to pinpoint one. There are two, Handy Medical as close as by here, and then Key Medical Group as close as by my residence in Shoreview. But needless to say, some of the things that are happening, how do we know that Medicare is going to pick a Minnesota provider and not get a provider from Florida? And there's a difference. You need a Midwest durable wheelchair to handle the snow and ice and salt, whereas if you get a Florida wheelchair, that constitutes not great durability. And I just wish that this program would have been thought out the first time. There seems to be a lot less flexibility in it. And I'm a little bit upset that a decision was made and the disability community wasn't consulted as to what might work or might not work for them. And this is a program that is not efficient. We need to make changes. We need to make them now.
Thank you. Thank you for this testimony. Are there others who wish to speak on this issue at this time? Seeing none, then I'm going to bring it into the committee for discussion. Are there any questions about the bill? Anything further that Senator Clausen, you'd like to say about the bill at this time?
No, Madam Chair. I'm just going to repeat that, you know, one of our goals, I think, as a state is to keep our disabled population within the community, and certainly providing the equipment for our most vulnerable citizens is critical, and this bill will allow us to continue to do so.
And Senator Clausen, the frustration that Mr. Hughes was expressing and the difficulties about having these products come from places where they're not designed to fit the environment that we live in here, do you believe that those issues are resolved as a result of this language?
You know, Madam Chair, that is an issue I'm quite not capable of perhaps rendering a decision on. I know in my discussions with people on this bill, most of the providers or many of the providers are not from Minnesota, and it's been explained many times they low bid but then don't deliver the goods. And then, as Mr. Hughes said as well, sometimes those products are really not designed adequately for different personal needs of people, or perhaps for dealing with the weather conditions and other issues here in Minnesota.
Well, thank you, Senator Clausen. I don't want to lose track of that concept. I know that this is to change the bidding process, the competitive bidding process, and may not actually resolve the issue that we're talking about here, but may need to come back and look at that again. Any other questions from the committee on Senate File 988? So we need a motion. As Senator Lori moves that Senate File 988, as amended, be passed and referred to Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Pass or opposed? It passes. Thank you. Thank goodness this is the last of the... It does pass. Thank you very much, Senator Clausen. Thank you to all who've come to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
Senator Herr is here with Senate File 1272.
Good morning, Madam Chairs and members.
Welcome, Senator, to the committee. Are there any amendments for your bill?
Yes, there's a delete all amendment. And pretty much is the same objective, but there's just a few changes. Language like on the original bill where it's 1.12, now the word psychiatric just changed to change it to mental health, and 1.13, children, insert person, and then 1.20, weather, insert death line. So it's just some technicality change on the language, but
Madam
the
Chair,
objective of the bill is very
similar.
Senator Lori offers the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you.
Thank
it passes.
You.
We can begin.
Okay. Thank you very much. The Deaf and Hard of Hearing Service Division has been serving Minnesota families for 35 years, and 40% of the division staff is deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing. With past budget cuts due to Department of Health and Human Services, the division was unable to perform tasks adequately in terms of direct assistant trainings and grants for mental health and deaf blind services, and TV news caption for Greater Minnesota. Some of the division programs were put on hold, and offices in Rochester and Bemidji were closed due to lack of funding. This put children and adults who are deaf, blind, and hard of hearing on the waiting list for services. This bill, Senate File 1272, would accomplish four important things. One, it increases grant money for direct services for the deaf-blind children and adult. And two, increase mental health service in ASL for children and adult. And three, increase the division ability to deliver. Four, pressing service and engage the community. And five, conduct study on how to effectively deliver service statewide. The latest research show that 20% of people in our state has a hearing loss that is significant enough to hinder the ability to communicate effectively. With the aging baby boomer on the rise, the service mentioned on this bill are significantly crucial. Senators and members, I ask for your support, and with me to testify is Danielle Hsu, a parent of a deaf-blind child. And also to my left here is Beth Fraser from the Deaf Heart and the Division of DHS, who may answer anything that get a little too technical.
Thank you very much. So, Ms. Hsu, would you say your name into the microphone and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Danielle Hsu, and I live in Minneapolis. Today, I'm sharing the experience of my son, Levi Hsu, who's a five-year-old who's deaf-blind as a result of severe brain damage. It was Christmas time, and we were expecting the birth of our first child. This was going to be the first child on both sides of the family, so the first grandchild. And my pregnancy had gone beautifully, and the day of birthing had arrived, and sure enough, we met our first child, a boy, for the first time, and it changed our world. He was born without a heartbeat or breath. He didn't move, and he didn't cry. Our son, Levi, had been born with severe brain damage, and there was no medical reason to explain why this had happened. In the weeks that followed, we learned that Levi is deaf-blind, and he's nonverbal. Today, Levi is 5 years old, and he has significant combined hearing and vision loss. His dual sensory loss gives him incomplete access to his environment. He has difficulty learning on his own using simple skills, such as observing or independent exploring. He's different from a child who's deaf because he cannot use his vision to compensate for what he cannot hear. He's different from a child who has vision loss because he cannot use his hearing to compensate for what he cannot see. Levi has profound vision and hearing loss. He is not able to rely on either his hearing or his vision, two senses that are critical in helping us access information. This has made it difficult for Levi to understand what's happening to him, what's happening in his environment around him, and his ability to express himself to others and the world around him. When Levi was 4 months old, we began working with early education specialists, including teachers, PTs, OTs, deaf, hard of hearing, vision teachers, all of individuals who were top of their field. And yet, it was not until Levi began working with a community intervener at age two that we saw a profound improvement in his ability to participate and communicate with others and the world around him. Deaf blindness is unlike any other disability. Other programs alone do not work for Levi and children with deaf blindness. The vast majority of people do not have the specialized skill and training and knowledge necessary to provide Levi with basic access. Only we have found interveners have this training. There's a photo in your packets that's a picture of Levi with his community intervener, Anna. And our family's been fortunate to have Anna Kors as our community intervener working with Levi. Anna visits for just a few hours a week in our home. And since Anna's begun working with Levi, he has less anxiety, which makes learning possible. Levi understands basic cause and effect. I create this action, a result happens. Prior to the intervener, Levi had no understanding of cause and effect. Levi is able to engage in meaningful independent play. Prior to the intervener, he needed full assistance, even with simple activities of play, vision, and engagement. Levi is now able to consistently communicate his emotions and be understood by his family and friends. Prior to the intervener, Levi stopped trying to communicate.
Thank you. Take your time. You can take your time.
He stopped trying because he knew he wasn't understood. Even at 2. A child who is deafblind, thank you, without access to an intervener is isolated, even in the context of their own family. Levi's intervener has transformed his ability to participate in our family and to be a part of life. There are studies and articles that show that with an intervener, a child who is deafblind is able to access information, able to communicate, and excel developmentally. A child with deafblindness with an intervener has an increase in communication behaviors. They're more engaged in their environment, people. These studies show positive reports that a child with deafblindness improves developmentally. An example of an intervener is Helen Keller's teacher, Ann Sullivan. I personally have met many parents with children with deafblindness throughout the state of Minnesota who would attest to these same results. Children with the supportive intervener have gone on to do the remarkable for them, to attend and graduate high school, to attend college, and to participate in meaningful jobs. I believe that for Levi, his intervener support has greatly helped him achieve critical, basic milestones, milestones that he would not have otherwise achieved. Levi is an example which proves that early intervention and support consistently from an intervener will continue to benefit him. It will continue to benefit any child with deafblindness. I'm asking for your consideration and approval for more funding for deafblindness, to provide funding for more training for professionals and families who support people with deafblindness, and for services for families and children. These resources are critical to our children, to our families, to our community statewide. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for this opportunity to address you on a serious issue that affects every child with deafblindness in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Hsu, and thank you for your story. I think when these stories are told, yours and others who of family members who are serving members of our community that are struggling with various difficulties and disabilities, that the expression that you had of your feeling today is felt by the families of all of these persons that are supported by the family. And I think it's really important for us here to understand that distress and how we increase that if we don't provide adequately for the supports your family needs. So thank you for that. I think that Is it Matt? There was a name. You said another person was here too.
Oh, Beth Fraser. She's Beth, here too. Okay. In case the question get a little
just
technical.
For questions, yeah, though. Okay. Question. Yeah. I thought I had another person's name that wanted to testify, but Beth is here for questions. Ms. Fraser, thank you for that. Is there anyone else that wishes to be heard on the bill?
I
righty. With that, I'm going to pull it in, Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, Senator Herr, thank you. It shows the involvement in early intervention services, and it would be really nice to see how the Part C team either interacted or didn't interact with this piece, because I think the outcome here is just wonderful. And thank you for coming and sharing your story. With that, Madam Chair, I want to move this bill.
Okay, Senator Hoffman moves. Senate file 1272 is amended, be passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there any further discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you, Senator Herr.
Thank you.
Thank you to the testifiers.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I suppose the next bill is also my bill.
Let me just, I'm just sort of catching up here. Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Senator. Yeah. It's Senate File 1889.
Okay. And I appreciate, again, the time that you allow me to put this bill into hearing. And I always see this committee and the committee I serve, which is Health and Human Service Budget Committee, all committee are great for our state, but I see this two committee as a more noble community to look at those that are have disability, and put little boost in life so that they could be productive equally with us. So I'm really appreciate. I'm also honored to serve in the budget committee too.
Thank you, Senator Herr. I just would add to what you're saying that earlier I was, struck by the expression of, I don't know if sorrow or sadness or is somehow the distress and difficulty that's on a person in a family supporting a person with a disability. And what I failed to say is so many times those same family members talk about the joys that they experience because this life was extended as a result of a new kind of tracheostomy that is flexible and the quality of life has increased. And we know about the joys as well. But what we're talking about today is what supports might be helpful to reduce some of that incredible distress that's on the families or the caregivers for persons who struggle with these disabilities. I was thinking I failed to mention the great joy that's also involved in this. So please proceed, Senator Herr.
Okay, thank you.
You have an amendment, I see. There's an yes, A1 amendment yes, that okay, Senator Lori is going to offer to your bill. So the A1 amendment is offered to 1889. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
And the amendment mainly just to authorize the commissioner to make aware of the grant to ethnic communities.
And are encouraged to apply, yes.
Yep. And to my introduction, there are over 81,000 Minnesotans who suffer from vision loss, and almost 70% of them are senior over age 65. Many are living in isolation, denying their vision loss for fear of embarrassment. Many of them are also living independently, but due to vision loss, they have problem performing easy tasks. This bill established a grant program that would provide this older adults in-home service so they will be able to gain the proper skill and training to live independently and confidently in the comfort of their own home. So this is a grant appropriation bill. I could maybe explain a little further down of the bill. The Section 1 mainly just lists out the criteria, the requirement to qualify for the grant, and the Section 2 lists the amount we're asking for. So, Madam Chair, member, I stand for question, and also with me to testify is Ms. Kate Grafford from Vision Loss Resources.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Grathwall. Would you say your name into the microphone and begin with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Senator Herr, members. My name is Kate Grathwall. I'm with Vision Loss Resources. As Senator Herr so nicely introduced, and this committee knows very well, that we have a growing population. Older adults will live well into their 90s. 1 in 4 of them will likely have some sort of vision loss. This vision loss will impair their ability to read their mail, read package directions for preparing food, take care of their personal finances, sort medications. And oftentimes we hear from clients that they thought they had, the only choice they had was to go into assisted living, spend down their savings, need supportive care. Vision Loss Resources and another nonprofit organization serving the blind and visually impaired in Duluth, Duluth Lighthouse for the Blind, actually have programs where we help people. We go into their home, show them a few adaptive techniques so that they can live independently, operate their stove and microwave safely so that they're not in fear of stopping eating because they're afraid of turning the stove dial to not 350, but actually broil and burning something instead of just baking it. So this appropriation is asking for an appropriation to go to DHS to set up a larger system to help us serve those older adults living in their home with vision loss, to help them stay in their home, to give them the tools they need to stay active and independent in their own lives, safe in their own homes, and also help them get out back into their community. Vision loss is very isolating. We don't want to let people know that we have vision loss because then they'll think maybe perhaps we aren't safe in our own home and we should go to assisted living. The whole idea behind this appropriation is if we spend a little money now, early intervention, keep people in their homes, they don't need to end up in assisted living, supported, possibly after spending down all of their savings using more state dollars through Medicaid, needing that, and they can stay at home and age in place.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Just a second. Let me just check and see if there's anybody else wishing to testify on the bill. Seeing no one, we'll close the public input. And Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Herr, the testifier. I appreciate the direction of the A1 amendment to try to make sure that we're able to serve culturally diverse communities, but I do wonder whether there are any eligible organizations serving ethnic communities in the way that the eligible organizations are defined, where the eligible organizations have to currently provide this long list of services. I actually kind of don't think there is an eligible organization that serves an ethnic community, and so if we're serious about trying to encourage that type of grantee in this, I don't think the A1 accomplishes that yet, unless you can correct me and say that there is somebody out there serving ethnic communities that does currently do this long list of things that is required to be an eligible organization here. And we see this sometimes frequently where a bill is designed for a particular grantee, and then we make ourselves feel better saying, oh, but we're going to give some preference to ethnic communities, but if you really get into it, not really. So just if we're serious about the A1, mm-hmm. I do worry that it's not accomplishing what
you are correct, Senator Tory, you are correct. I couldn't see any, organization locally that could serve that aspect, but I would like to just commission the commissioner to spread the word a little bit wider. So perhaps there's one out there it's not in our database that we overlook. So we want to throw the net wide, but you are correct on that sense.
Any other questions, Senator Herr? This will be referred to finance, and what I would ask of you before you are there that you add another amendment to this bill that articulates the outcomes that we would get from this expenditure, what the people of the state are going to get in return for this expenditure. And may I suggest, given what we're talking about here, that one of the measures be whether or not we were able to distribute these resources to organizations that are serving ethnic communities. I'd like to have some specific feedback about that, as well as I see that your services provided, which is where I go for measurements sometimes, for the articulation of measurements, you're talking about a lot of this is it's going to be numbers, how many in-home assessments were done, how many people were trained in safety mechanisms, how many were trained in independent living skills, how many did retain the ability to stay in their home, how many were able to avoid a more restrictive or higher structured environment. So articulating some of those measures and then a report back date on that. And one of those might include so that we can look and see whether or not we were successful in being able to do what you're saying in this amendment.
Madam Chair, yes, I will put some time to research and add on a few new language to this bill when it enter the Finance Committee.
That'd be great. And a date for the report back.
I suppose Ms. Kate do have a little answer for you in terms of, you know, the return. Can you?
Certainly. Both Vision Loss Resources and the Duluth Lighthouse have ways of measuring what we do, and these part of why we want to go to DHS with the appropriation is then they have an excellent measurement system, and they can also help us because they have a number of grants, living at home, wellness grant. So they have a lovely structure that we can take the data that we always do collect because Duluth and we do capture this information. But then going to DHS allows us to do that larger measurement and also would – through their RFP process, create ways in which we can measure the long-term effect of this. So we do have a way where we call back and ask our clients at 6 and a year, how are they doing, what do they need? But with DHS's help, they would create an RFP proposal that would create very nice measurements because they ask this in all their other grants. So this is a way we can give you that information back.
Well, that sounds wonderful, but we would really appreciate something articulated in the bill language about that with an expectation that it be reported back. I don't know, even if you're referring to the measurements that are utilized already, mm-hmm. That those be done and that the outcomes of that be reported back by a certain date.
Certainly.
I know you can't do the long-term measurements, but mm-hmm. you can do some of the short-term measurements. Okay, great. Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves Senate File 1889 as amended be passed and be referred to Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you very much, Senator Hur. And
thank you, Madam Chair and member.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman, Senate File 1062.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1062 is modifying the disability waiver rate system. This is a continuation of the conversation Senator Rosen and I co-authored a bill 2 years ago. And as promised, I'll give you just a brief overview of what that was about 2 years ago and the continuation of the conversation today.
Senator Hoffman, may I interrupt you? I'm sorry to ask that the Senator Hoffman offers the A4 delete everything amendment be passed. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. With me at the table today is Lynn Noren from RISE Incorporated. She's going to speak on behalf of a large, broad coalition of DWRS stakeholders. And Madam Chair, Senate File 1062 modifies the system that determines the medical assistance payment rates for providers who serve people with disabilities in the community. The bill is a continuation and a continuing effort to adjust the disability waiver rate system, also known as DWRS, as it transitions from a county-by-county rate-setting system to one that meets the federal government's requirements of a statewide uniform rate-setting methodology. The new statewide system began in January 2013 after many years of work in developing, including much negotiation and collaboration. In implementing the new system, there were two concepts, Madam Chair and Senators, that guided the implementation strategy. And these are two concepts that I'm going to hold to this day. The first was to move to a uniform methodology while maintaining budget neutrality. I can't even say that word anymore. No more or no less money would be spent in the system because of the change in methodology. The second was to make sure that safeguards are in place to not only protect people with disabilities in Minnesota, but also to protect the infrastructure of community-based services that support them in their day-to-day lives during the transition to a new system. Remember, we did a five-year yes, thank you, Madam Chair, for remembering that. Senate File 1062 continues to move the system forward by improving the integrity of the new system and continuing with the needed protections for the community services that support our folks with disabilities. A legislation that has a broad range of advocacy and provider groups, but now I'd like to turn the presentation over to Lynn Noren from RISE, and then I'll stand for questions after that.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Welcome, Ms. Noren. Would you say your name into the microphone and begin your testimony?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Noren, and I'm from RISE Incorporated, a provider of services to people who have disabilities. We provide employment, housing, and personal support. I'm here today on behalf of MORE, which is an association of day service providers throughout the state of Minnesota, and also representing the coalition. I want to first thank Senator Hoffman for his continued efforts to tackle this complex and challenging topic, and for the bipartisan group of co-authors for your support as well. Senate File 1062 continues to move the implementation of DWRS forward to strengthen protections for the community services that support people who have disabilities. The bill has 10 sections that fall into three general categories. Four sections, Section 1, 9, 3, and 8, assure that the implementation of DWRS is as intended. Sections 1 and 9 remove penalties for county overspending their waiver allocations and add language to encourage counties to spend their waiver allocations. We believe that the penalties that counties receive have influenced some county behaviors concerning DWRS. Section 3 strengthens the county training and oversight provisions. Section 8 adds detail to the exception process that can be used by individuals who have special circumstances and needs that cannot be met through the regular rate-setting process. There are four sections, Sections 2, 5, 6, and 10, that strengthen the protections of consumers and providers while the transition to the new system continues. Section 2 adds a sixth year of banding to the transition to the new system, or what we call banding, and reduces the banding amount in year 3 from 1% to 0.5%. Sections 5 and 6 adjust factors within the rate setting system to more closely align the process with budget neutrality. Section 10 extends the banding period, which is the ability, extends throughout the period of banding the ability of the commissioner to make budget neutrality adjustments. Two sections, Section 4 and 7, are addressing other identified issues. Section 4 addresses shared staffing in residential services, and Section 7 has other issues to be studied. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time to hear this bill. On behalf of the coalition, I would like to ask for your support of Senate File 1062.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman, did you have anything further at this time?
No, Madam Chair, I just wanted to let the committee know that the coalition and DHS have not reached full agreement on a couple of things, but the conversation has continued since the very beginning of 2 years ago. And that continues to be a work in progress. And we asked that from the very beginning. And I just would ask that Senate File, as we continue this extended conversation, it is a $1.3 billion system in Minnesota. And it is a big system. I would ask that with the continuation of work in progress, that Senate File 1062 be moved to the, with amendment, be moved to the Finance Committee so that the continuation of the collaboration and work can continue and find agreement.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. I think that I'm going to ask, is DHS here and able to come to the table?
Yeah, Ms. Hamilton is here.
Ms. Hamilton, and while she's coming, Senator, you said that there are some issues yet to be resolved. Are they issues with the that the department has, is the question, or are they issues that are inherent in how this is being is impacting the various portions of the system?
Madam Chair and members, there are a couple of things. The A1, the A4 amendment shows some consolidation and agreement and some issues. The continued issues that are there, I think, has to deal with where the budget neutrality question comes into being and who's fiscal. That's where the conversation, there's more questions that DHS, that we have for DHS and DHS has for us. And that's, I think, the gist of that. Yeah, Ms. Hamilton is shaking her head yes. So I think we can come to some kind of work before we get to Senator Lori.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. You wanted to speak. I think this is an important issue. You know, it's been budget neutrality is sort of the rubber band around this whole thing, and it's moving. It's difficult to do budget neutrality when you're moving how you're going to be paying for resources back and forth, who the winners and losers are in the process, and it creates a lot of tension. So am I hearing that that's not yet resolved in this bill?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We are still talking with the coalition. We haven't reached an agreement in that area. We have a meeting later today.
That's a big deal, I think so. Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, you're right. It is a big deal because in one sense the conversation is when do you look at the banding rate from the year before, you look at the banding rate from when it started. And so there's some conversations about that issue on whose money and what money is it where it's at. And we'll have this not like last year where we thought we had it and Senator Lori, we tabled and came back and we did have it. So again, you guys, this system is huge and it is it's a continued work and we're going to be here until we get it right, because I think we owe it on behalf of everybody in the state of Minnesota that have within these community-based service providers.
Ms. Hamilton, is there anything further that you would like us to know from the Department of Human Services?
Not at this time, Madam Chair.
All right. And other members of the committee, do you have questions? Now, I'd like to say thank you to you, Senator Hoffman. I know that this is really a complex interplay of components to try to operate and to improve within a budget neutrality. So I appreciate the reform and the effort to make the change and to struggle through to find the correct solution to this. So thank you for that. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say that this was one of the agendas that Senator Hoffman has talked about right from the very beginning. And it might take a few years to get it done, but you'll get it right.
Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion? Senator Hoffman renews his motion. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Thank you very much.
I don't know if we want this done.
You are.
But it has to be.
Do you have another bill? Yeah. You may have more than this. Let's give it a heads up. We do have time.
Hello, Senator Rosen.
Thank
Good
you,
morning.
Minister. Good morning. Thank you. Senate File 866 is the 2016 Smile Healthy Minnesota Grant Program. This was brought forward by the Concordia students, which I have here, and it's a wonderful grant program, an idea that they thought of that deals with our dental situation in Minnesota. As you know, Madam Chair, members, we've been talking much more about the dental situation and how dire it is in the state, and how important proper dental care is to not only our children but to our vulnerable, our adults, and well, basically everybody, just for the well-being of our medical and dental situation. So with that, Madam Chair, I do have the A1 amendment. It's a delete all that I'd like to move.
Senator Rosen offers the A1 delete all amendment. All those in favor say aye. Was that you, Senator Rosen?
Yes, aye.
I'm voting yes, too. Anybody else?
I said aye.
Aye, okay. All those opposed say nay. Passes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And basically, the amendment takes out a few things as far as some language saying that there had to be the person that's providing the care had to have at least 20 employees, and that it had to be a mobile dental center, and it's just refined a little bit. Some of the work was done over in the House, and I appreciate Ms. Kavanaugh's work on that too. With that, as you know, we have one of the lowest reimbursement rates and pediatric coverage in the nation, and I think this is what the Concordia students were very concerned about, and I appreciate their effort to bring this forward. So I'm going to let them explain a little bit about the program and how it came to be. With that, I have Chris Plouch.
Say your name, Chris, into the microphone, and please begin your testimony. And then as we move with the other students, I don't have your names here, so you'll need to say them and highlight Senator Rosen's testimony.
Good morning, Chair Sharon and members of the committee. My name is Chris Plouch, and I'm joined by my classmates Elizabeth Coates and Claire Hauser from Concordia University. We have many traditions at Concordia, and one of them is turning the Capitol into our real-life classroom. We've researched, drafted, and passed legislation over the past few sessions that we are very proud of. This year, I couldn't be more thrilled to talk to you about the Smile Healthy Minnesota Legislative Act, or Senate File 866, which is chief authored by our mentor, Senator Julie Rosen, along with Senators Nelson, Marty, Stumpf, and Benson. In the House, our companion bill is chief authored by Representative Nick Zerwas, along with our co-authors there. We have good news and bad news. First, the bad news. Minnesota, we have a grim healthcare reality that needs to be faced today. There's a dentist shortage across the state of Minnesota. We have a bigger problem. Residents of group homes, special need patients on Medicaid, and vulnerable adults with disabilities aren't able to have access to proper dental care outside the 7-county metro area. Let me better explain. We've heard many patient stories similar to this one. An adult group home resident with mental and physical disabilities, wheelchair-bound, living in Warren, Minnesota, needs to be transported to Minneapolis to have a simple dental appointment by one of the handful of Minnesota nonprofits providing the service. The Warroad group home packs up the residents, usually has a driver and a second staff member travel with the resident to the Minneapolis area for their dental appointment. They either need to stay overnight or travel right back home. This can be anywhere from a 10 to 12 hour process.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we also have Elizabeth Coates and Claire Hauser.
Ms. Coates, please say your name and begin your testimony. And then, Ms. Hauser, you can begin as soon as Ms. Coates is finished.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Elizabeth Coates. This isn't a one-time incident. It's a hardcore reality for Minnesotans with special needs. Now for the good news. For 2 years, we've researched, studied, talked with multiple agencies and legislators about a solution. We believe, along with Senator Rosen and Representative Nick Zerwas, that we have a straightforward answer for this pressing problem. We learned long ago inside the Capitol the term FTM, follow the money. It's a key to figuring out legislation. We aren't lobbyists. We aren't dentists. We aren't group home workers. We are students who have listened to and with Senator Rosen and Representative Zerwas. Our legislative intent is simple, to provide an answer.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Claire Hauser. We believe that creating an opportunity for those nonprofit organizations that wish to create mobile dentistry units is a smart, efficient, effective, and fiscal answer. This way, these units have the ability to travel to rural, underserved regions of the state. Isn't this a better use of the 12-hour day? With our solution, a dentist could see multiple patients in one day, literally a dental office on wheels. From special chairs to all the right equipment, these mobile vans are crucial to ensuring dental access across all of Minnesota. Senate File 866 creates a new Minnesota grant of $500,000 through the Department of Health and Human Services to go to the patients. We would like to help provide funding to bring dental mobile units to Medicaid patients most needing access, treatment, and care. Over the past 2 weeks, our companion bill in the House has passed through both health committees with no opposition. With our cooperative efforts, we hope to start seeing the smile back on our most vulnerable Minnesota residents. We want a solution. We want to see progress made. We believe this will save money and time while providing increased access. Members and Madam Chair, we ask for your support and leadership in passing Senate File 866.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions or anything further, Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say, too, that the grantees must report to the commissioner on their dental health outcomes. I think that's very important, and you have stressed that in many other areas. As you know, pediatric care is extremely important, and I think that is what is these mobile units can reach that pediatric population to at least put in that start of those varnishes that can be preventive type of dental care. I think that's important. And as you know, we have an initiative going forward in this committee also that's sent to the finance about a rate reimbursement increase for our dental providers. And I do know that North Dakota, they had an 85% rate increase, and they only saw a 1% increase in access. So it worries me that just with a rate increase, we are not going to increase our access, and we have to, again, be creative and think of how to provide those services. So this mobile unit, something that the Concordia students came up with, I think this is a wonderful springboard, and perhaps we can move something like this forward. I think it would be great.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to the students at Concordia for bringing this. Very important, and to realize that so much can be prevented just through good preventative care, especially with our youngest Minnesotans. So I think it's critically important. I have a question, and I'm wondering if someone could define for me the health professional shortage area is defined under the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 42, Part 5, Section 254E. I'm trying to find that here just to see specifically if Olmsted County is included. And I'm wondering if someone has access to defining that area for me.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I do know Olmsted County has one of the lowest pediatric coverages in the state. And I believe this is the HPSA. Is that correct, Ms. Kavanaugh? I believe it is the low underserved.
It's. I think we could ask the Department of Health to be able to respond to this question.
Yes.
Thank you. Good morning, members. Mark Schoenma from the Health Department. Senator Nelson, I think the committee has seen maps of these shortage areas in other meetings. There's no such thing as a perfect measure to capture everything that's going on. And Olmsted County is not designated as a health professional shortage area. This conversation also took place in the House. There are perhaps some additional indicators that you might want to consider adding.
Thank you.
If that's your interest.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you so much for clarifying. That was my recollection, too, as I've looked at those health shortage areas. Olmsted County was not included. And Senator Rosen, you are correct, only it's even worse than that. I am embarrassed to say that Olmsted County has the lowest ranking in the state for pediatric dental health. And so I would like to work with you, Senator Rosen, on amending this bill to make sure that while this is a federal definition, which might have a broader scope, this is a very limited bill in that it defines pediatric dental care. And so I'm hoping there's a metric that we can, add to this bill so that Olmsted County would be included as well, since it has the lowest ranking.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, actually, Senator Nelson, thank you for that. But on line 12, it provides dental services as at-risk children, adolescents, adults, and seniors in a health professional shortage area. But we could certainly put Olmsted, because you are not in the health.
Yeah, correct.
But it does cover our vulnerable and also all adults. And I think that's important.
Thank you.
Sarah Nelson.
Madam Chair, my reading, though, of the language says that they need to be in a health professional shortage area as defined under the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 42, Part 5, United States Code, Title 42. And so what I'm saying is, as the bill is written right now, the county that has the worst pediatric dental coverage in the state would not qualify for this fine piece of legislation. And my hope is that we can personalize our metrics a bit more to the state of Minnesota and include Olmsted County and whatever. And I can make that amendment if you'd like. If you'd like it to be specific by county, or if maybe there's a different way, a different metric that would be a better way to amend that. Is this the only place to amend this bill, Madam Chair?
It's going to go to finance, but may I ask from the Department of Health, is there another metric that's really specific to the state that identifies this these shortage areas that really are related to the facts of this state in this particular area?
Madam Chair and members, again, there's no perfect indicator. What we have come up with in response to a request in the House was that if you leave this indicator and add, I don't have the citation offhand, but sites that are designated as critical access dental providers by the Department of Human Services, you pick up another set of nonprofit providers, including those that are active in Olmsted County.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator
Actually,
Rosen.
there is a thought that we've been
thrown around,
ruminating on for the last few days, is to have these mobile units serve critical access hospitals, which would get into you are a critical access hospital in Olmsted County. But we did not have that refined enough. But that there are how many critical access hospitals?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there are 79 critical access hospitals. There are none in Rochester.
Right. So, Madam Chair?
Senator, slow down here. I got to recognize you guys here. So, thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum. Senator Nelson.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I'd like to, rather than trying to do this at the drafting table here, I mean, the one thing I could amend is to say add Olmsted County, which is the lowest ranking county for coverage. On the other hand, if there's a better metric that gets to the lowest ranking based upon a particular designation, I'd rather do that. So, Senator Rosen, might I work with you before finance? Yes.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Nelson, I would certainly appreciate it working with the Concordia students too. This is their
absolutely.
Bill. And I'd like to have them to weigh in on this too. So.
Yes. So,
Senator Nelson.
So while I'm tempted to offer an amendment to specifically add Olmsted County because of its very poor ranking, I think I'll defer to Senator Rosen and the CLAC students, and we'll try and come up hopefully with a metric that makes sure that this bill actually allows those that are in the greatest need to actually access this fine piece of legislation that you've put together. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Schoenbaum. Senator Rosen, one of the things that I thought, I noted that there were two already existing mobile services like this that are not eligible for the grant. Is that correct?
Madam Chair,
well, they are now. They are now. Okay.
I actually did not know.
Oh, okay. So you changed the number of employees so that they would be
right.
eligible.
Yes, I take the employees out.
Okay, and how this is a grant that has that that it is a 2016-2017. What's the sustainability of this system? Does there have to be a different source of revenue other than the state supporting these programs in the future? Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, that probably is the big question in the room, is how do you sustain this ongoing? And that would be what some of the outcomes hopefully will show to the commissioner when that report is filed in 2018, that we did have increased access and it is worth the investment going forward. But
I wondered about that, because I would just suggest, if you would not mind, that you add a number 4 after line 1.21 that includes to be eligible for a grant, the nonprofit must develop a sustainability plan.
I'm sure I think that would be appropriate.
Okay. I think that communicates something about spending some time thinking about if they value this, how they're going to continue to pay for it. So mm-hmm. I would make that an oral amendment.
So moved.
Is that okay? Clear? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
You need to, do you need any clarifications on that?
Okay, it passes. All righty. Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I move Senate File 866 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you very much. All those in favor say aye.
Thank you.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much. And now, Senator Hayden on Senate File 679.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee to present Bill Senate File 679. I see you have a delete all amendment, so we'll take care of that first. Senator Hayden offers the A2 delete everything amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you. Senator
Good.
Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 679, requires a notice to hospital patients regarding the observation stays and establishes discharge planning requirements. It is somewhat technical, so Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers to let them walk you through the bill and the rationale for it.
Okay, thank you. We have Ms. Danielle
Holkhalter
from Leading Age Minnesota and Aaron Bui from Care Providers Minnesota. Please say your names in the microphone. That way we're sure that they're being articulated correctly. And begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Aaron Bui. I'm Director of Government Affairs for Care Providers of Minnesota, here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I want to thank Senator Hayden for bringing this bill forward.
We've already had it.
If you'd like, I can just walk through what the bill does. And
sure.
Okay. The observations say.
Be sure to pull your microphone forward. I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Yes.
Madam Chair, sorry about that. Section 1 of the bill deals with the observation stay notice. What this does is, within 24 hours of placing a patient in observation status, a hospital must provide oral and written notice to the patient that the hospital has done so. In many instances, a patient will need medical stabilization and rehabilitation care at a skilled nursing facility following their discharge from a hospital, which can only be accessed under their Medicare benefit if the patient was admitted to the hospital as an inpatient for at least 3 days. So there are times when patients will arrive at a skilled nursing facility and not understand that they have not been admitted to the hospital as inpatient, and rather have been under observation stay. So then their benefit is not covered and their stay is not covered. So we're just trying to give the patients more information so that they know what kind of costs they're looking at coming out of the hospital. And then Section 2 provides information and planning for seniors and their families when they are discharged from a hospital, so they understand the choices they may have for location and type of post-hospital care. Section 2 language is by and large taken from federal hospital conditions of participation and then gives consumers and families the section requires hospitals to, as part of discharge planning, provide a list of available Medicare-eligible home care agencies or skilled nursing facilities that serve patients. We have had instances where patients have said that they have been only given one choice, and it has sometimes been hours away from their families. So we just want to ensure that they're given a complete list so that they're able to make the best choice available to them and their families. And I will turn it over to my colleague to talk about the lodging portion of the bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Danielle Hochalter. I'm Director of Government Affairs for Leading Age Minnesota, and I'm also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. In Section 2, to give you a little bit of background, a couple years ago, Housing with Services establishments, specific with a special care unit, were required to have a lodging license under 157. There's been some uncertainty and different interpretations of this law that requires all Housing with Services to have a lodging requirement. So we, the Section 2 part of that just clarifies that. So Housing with Services as a whole does not require a lodging license under 157, but just special care units will continue to have that lodging license with the expectation that a report will be required on January 15th of 2016 to look at what requirements to the physical plant of a memory care unit to ensure the safety and sanitary requirements of a memory care unit. There are some regulations under 157 that don't apply or aren't really applicable to Housing with Services establishments in memory care, such as they require beds to be a certain distance away from one another, and throughout that statute require or refer to individuals as guests instead of tenants, with the most of these are applied to hotel-like settings. So to give you a background on that. So we want to have extra regulation and oversight. We're in agreement that people with dementia should be, since they are the most vulnerable population, have that oversight, but ones that make sense to those individuals since they are tenants and not guests.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Am I reading this correct, Senator Hayden? This last issue about subject to lodging requirements is new in your delete all amendment. We had not seen that prior to this time.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Has the Department of Health been involved in the conversation about this?
Yes. Madam Chair.
Please, go ahead.
Members of the committee, yes, they have been in conversations. These conversations started about 2.5 years ago, and we reached this agreement with the study to go forward that way.
Is the department here to speak to this section of the bill? Appears that there's not anyone here. Okay. Anyone else wishing to testify on the bill at this time? Just a moment, please, Senator Hayden. We're just talking about the fact that the department's not here. We will need to talk to the department about this section, but we aren't able to do that at this time. This is going to finance as well. So it's referred to finance. We'll have an opportunity, if there are any issues, to bring it up again. Any discussion of committee members? There was another thing here. Just let me have a chance to read something, Senator Hayden. I'm sorry. Too many things going back and forth. For discharge planning that include but may not be limited to... patient's capacity, the patient's... You know, I think under subdivision 2, Senator Hayden, this is so picky, I'm sorry I'm even bringing it up, but I'm going to do it anyway. You know, the 2 under number 1, the two I's or the 2 or whatever that's called, when you're talking about post-acute care discharge planning, I just think that it would be clear if you said of the patient's capacity discharge planning for that resolves or that is designed to resolve that is aligned with the person's capacity for self-care. All we're saying here is, but may not be limited to the patient's capacity for self-care. And I think you want something further than that. I think you want the discharge plan to somehow address their capacity for self-care.
So, Madam Chair, just I appreciate you analyzing this, but apparently this is pretty technical stuff, and this was from the federal Medicare rules. So the language that you see that you're wrestling with was kind of it's been taken, and it's pretty technical. At least that's what I'm coming to understand about this. So I hesitate on – I mean, this does have another stop, and if folks want to take another look, but I would hesitate to start to change language when it looks like it's pretty technical in nature.
Okay. Mr. Monahan.
Madam Chair, I think when you're looking at Romanet 2, you've skipped Clause 1. So Clause 1 reads, conducting a discharge planning evaluation that includes an evaluation of – then you go down to Romanet 2, the patient's capacity for self-care, or an evaluation of the possibility of the patient being cared for in the environment.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. All right, Senator Hayden. Has there been a conversation with the hospitals and the Hospital Association in relationship to the bill, Senator Hayden?
Yes, Madam Chair. We have affirmative nodding from the Hospital Association's representative.
Okay, just want to make sure everybody's all lined up. Any further discussion? All those in Senator Hayden.
So, Madam Chair, thank you so much. I'd like to move Senate File 679 as amended to the Committee on Finance.
To the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good job.
It passes. Okay, thank you. Welcome, Senator Benson. We have the committee's engrossment of the bill that is Senate File 809, Charity Healthcare Services Individual Income Tax Deduction, was referred to taxes, and we have this. This is the bill in front of us. We are not acting on this bill today. It's not in front of us in that degree, but apparently Senator Skoy and Rest wanted you to at least discuss the idea with the committee for some sort of reaction or discussion. So would you proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senate File 809 has been laid over for possible inclusion in the tax bill. The tax committee did ask me to come here for policy advice. As members know, we face a healthcare workforce shortage. Senator Claussen has Senate File 3, which is a loan forgiveness program. This is a complement to that loan forgiveness program to reach healthcare workers that might not have loans, but to give them some incentive to participate in volunteer activities for critical access, for facilities in critical access areas and federally qualified health centers. It is a tax subtraction that would require the individual and the entity to submit an informational report based on the value of charity care services at our medical assistance rates. The bill, as currently amended, requires 120 hours of volunteer activity per year, and that I put in place so that the health facility could be planful about what resources would be available to them. Again, this only applies to services in critical access areas and federally qualified health centers. And I will tell you, Madam Chair, the tax committee, I was only given a revenue note of $600,000 because, according to the Department of Revenue, federally qualified health centers have no capacity to take volunteers. So, Madam Chair and Committee, if I could ask Jonathan Watson to come forward and explain a little bit how the Department of Revenue might have misunderstood what is possible and some things this committee should consider.
Mr. Watson.
Great. excuse me. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name again is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent the state's 17 federally qualified health centers. And I do truly appreciate Senator Benson's efforts here to really foster some volunteer work at the state's federally qualified health centers. Just going to give you a very brief history lesson here, but the employees of an FQHC are covered by what's called the Federal Tort Claims Act. This was established in 1946, and it's established for persons that were wronged by the federal government to receive some compensation for that. In 1995, it was, Congress actually extended this FTCA coverage to employees of community health centers. And the theory there was the monies that we were spending on malpractice insurance should rather go to serving uninsured individuals. So we received this FTCA coverage to free up dollars to serve uninsured individuals. One of the problems with the FTCA program on the federal level is it does not cover volunteers working at a community health center. So we do not have any ability to cover their liabilities, and that's why you don't see a lot of volunteers at FQHCs. Nonetheless, there are some FQHCs that do employ volunteers on a limited basis, and they do purchase malpractice insurance from other sources here in the state. There's an FQHC right here in St. Paul that offers ophthalmology services for diabetic patients through a volunteer program, and also brings in cardiologists for individuals with cardiovascular disease or that are at risk of cardiovascular disease. So, again, we do welcome the spirit of this intent to foster more volunteers, but we do have two significant barriers to promote more volunteers. The first one I'll group as legal and financial. I already outlined the FTCA problem that we have uncovering volunteers, but the financial piece of it too. I think you're all familiar with our patient population being a very poor population. The operating margins at community health centers just aren't there to go out and purchase malpractice insurance because it can be expensive. The second bucket is administrative issues, and it really gets down to credentialing. The FQHCs, for a volunteer to come in one day a month, getting them through the credentialing process, they look at a cost-benefit analysis of that, and it may not be worth our while to go through that exhaustive credentialing for the provider. And secondarily, the administrative piece is having them proficient in our electronic medical records. Getting them trained up until that point, just for a volunteer basis once a month, may not be worth it from our perspective. I do see two main pathways to move forward to get more volunteers into FQHCs. And the first is looking at bringing volunteers within the four walls of FQHCs, in which some health centers are doing that now. But in terms of looking at active providers bringing their current malpractice policy with them, the organization still has liability and is exposed. And if a retired doc comes and volunteers at an FQHC, again, they don't have malpractice insurance, nor does the organization. We need to work to find some creative solutions to take care of that malpractice exposure that we have. But the second pathway, which I'm excited about, is really engaging specialty providers outside the four walls of the community health center. Looking at networks of endocrinologists for diabetic patients, for example, or ophthalmologists and podiatrists. If specialty networks that exist out there would devote and carve out and volunteer time to see some of our uninsured patients in particular, this would do a lot for the continuity of care and really get at eliminating those health disparities. I've done some just limited research, and there are 43 states in the United States, including Minnesota, that do offer some sort of malpractice coverage for volunteers. And there is definite interest of the 17 FQHCs. I've just been engaged with them in the last 48 hours on this issue. And they're really coming forth with ideas related to rheumatology and pain management, dental specialists, and provision of dental care through volunteer basis. It's just we need to fix some of these administrative and financial issues for FQHCs to participate. So I want to work with Senator Benson and all of you this session, next session, whichever session, anything to really promote greater access to care for underserved communities that we serve.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, two questions, one for Mr. Watson and one for Senator Benson. For Mr. Watson, in other words, the best way to address this so you could take volunteers would be to have the state underwrite either, or one other option would be that instead of a just deduction for the value of their services, we could actually include a credit for the cost of, and I don't know if a doctor volunteering can get malpractice for that number of hours or something, but something like that, that would be one thing. Is there a way to do that?
And Madam Chair,
Senator Benson,
and I'm sure Mr. Watson will correct me, but I gave you a copy of Statute 1440, which is volunteer health care provider, which has nexus to, I believe it, is it $50 malpractice insurance?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct. Senator Benson.
But this is the administrative headache that the FQHCs face, and so my next step in moving this forward is to see if we can streamline 214.40 to make it easier for FQHCs to take volunteer docs. And for $50, the state does subsidize malpractice insurance. So if we could make it a little easier for them to get it, they would be more likely to engage at our FQHCs, is my understanding.
Correct.
Senator Marty?
Thank you. So in other words, there's potential for that. It's confusing, and you're trying to work on it. The other question was the individuals qualified. Basically, this would be physician, physician assistant, advanced dental therapist, mental health professional, public health nurse. How did you pick those? And
Senator Benson?
And Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I took the language from Senator Klassen's Senate File 3 for both providers and geographic distribution so that this really is a complement to Senate File 3. If you don't have debt, but you still, you know, we could, as a state, give them a thank you, a little attaboy for stepping up and volunteering at a pretty high level of expectation.
Madam Chair, I think it's good choice of language then, and I think it fits in nicely then.
Senator Marty, thank you. Is there any further questions? Is there any other specific part of the bill that the Tax Committee wanted us to react to, Senator Benson?
Madam Chair and members, they were concerned that their revenue note was too small, and so they wanted me to work on ways to make it a little bit bigger. So if this committee has advice, I know that is, it never happens, so don't let anybody hear that. Anyone has advice for how we could, maybe it's reducing the number of hours. I've consulted with Mr. Watson to see if 120 hours is a practical number. I set the bar very high because I was a little concerned about the revenue note, Madam Chair. And so any advice on that would be appreciated.
Well, other than the number of hours, how do you impact the fiscal note? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, if, again, it may be more complicated than that, but again, if you were to say just the entire cost of malpractice insurance, again, if I'm a cardiologist in St. Paul and I want to work for his clinic and I'm willing to volunteer that time, if I can pay extra for that, if you actually allowed a dollar, 100% tax credit for that, again, it's still complicated, but then the doctor would be bringing the malpractice insurance. We'd be that would add a significant portion because you're only allowing the deduction for it here, but for the malpractice portion, for the extra expense they have of doing it, if we covered it, we in effect would be covering it through tax credit that way. That would add costs, and this is an unusual conversation to have. So. but I think the reason the Tax Committee was asking you that is because they like the idea, and they're saying if we can get this much value for our dollar here,
that's
let's
an
do
idea.
More of it.
What's your reaction, Senator Benson?
I will look into it. I think a very interesting idea. I don't know enough about malpractice insurance to know if there would simply be an add-on for volunteer and we would give a credit for that, or if we would give full credit for malpractice insurance. So, Madam Chair, as I do more research, I will have a better idea of its viability going forward. And Madam Chair, members, I'm going to also ask Mr. Watson to get a summary of volunteers or an estimate of volunteers already working at FQHCs and send that to the Department of Revenue and look for a redraft on that note.
Thank you. Mr. Watson, you talked about, and I think you already have, people who are not retired. These are people who are experts who have specialty licensure who are volunteering in the federally qualified healthcare centers, who are already insured for mm-hmm. their own practice where they're employed, and they can bring that and operate under that malpractice insurance in your clinics. Is that correct,
Madam Chair? That is correct.
But I thought there was another part of that, and that is that even with the provider having malpractice or liability insurance, the clinic will also have liability. Separate from that.
Madam Chair, that is exactly correct, and that is one of my concerns, is as these volunteers bring their own malpractice, the organization, the FQHC itself, still has some exposure, so we need malpractice coverage for the organization as well, and that's the piece that gets expensive and the piece that FTCA does not cover.
And that might be what you're talking about, Senator Benson, trying to resolve if we can. Oh, except for you don't get tax, you know. How do we resolve that with a bill that's giving a tax credit? See, it's an organization here that does not get tax credits, the Federally Qualified Healthcare Center. So,
Madam Chair, again, there are, in my research, again, there are kind of three different approaches that these other 43 states are doing. And some states give statutory immunity to organizations as well. It creates like an FTCA program on the state level. And that's something states have. I think Michigan and Virginia are two examples of that. And that would, if we implement that here in Minnesota, that would protect the organization. So our exposure is limited.
Senator Benson, is that something you think you would want to integrate into this year's bill?
I will continue working on it. I don't know that I would take that to the tax committee as an amendment. Right now we have a good place, and if I commit to them that I'll work on expanding it, I think we take the expansion that we can get and then work over the interim to see what we can do with 214.40, to see what we can do about an administrative exemption for these facilities. I think I have a lot more work to do. Madam Chair, as you are well aware, every single thing we open up has levels of complication. So.
Okay, good. And then the last issue, the barrier that you're talking about for the Federally Qualified Health Centers is the, it might be for others as well, is the cost that you incur in training in a volunteer. So you'd want to have at least a minimum number of hours that the person's volunteering to make the investment in training them on your electronic medical record.
Madam Chair, Mr. Watson? Yes, that is correct. Because, again, you know, having them trained in, if they're just coming for one day a month, it's hardly worth our while to have them proficient in the electronic medical record. So maybe some minimum threshold of volunteer hours would be appropriate.
Well, we wouldn't necessarily have to set that. That could be something that you would set organizationally, correct? We wouldn't have to do that legislatively.
Correct, Madam Chair. That is correct.
Typically, how large is one of your federally qualified health care centers? How many providers are billing out of a federal qualified? Is it huge variations?
Madam Chair, yes, it is a huge variation. Maybe a good way to look at it is in terms of patients. We have some FQHCs that serve as small as 4,000 individuals per year, and then we have a large community health center here in St. Paul that serves nearly 35,000 individuals per year. So it does vary.
The reason I ask that is because there's been some discussion about giving relief from the electronic medical records for very small solo practitioners. We're trying to take a look at if there's a place for some relief from that obligation, but I guess that won't necessarily help in this circumstance. Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Watson can expound on this, but they actually came to us, was it last year, and asked for money so that they could expand their electronic medical records. So I don't think they'll be seeking relief. They just want utilization of volunteers to not be a burden.
Right. Correct.
All righty. You and I against the world. That way we're going to be able to move the bill if you'd like, Senator Benson. Oh, no, we're not taking action. We're just having a conversation.
Action.
Thank you.
I've already got the language where we need it. We just needed advice so I can go back to Department of Revenue, Senator Scully and Senator Rust.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
That completes our meeting, and we are adjourned.